session number 11939, rule 19.
When and where did you land in Italy, Mr. Williams?
Well, for about a week. There'd been a heavy barrage being fired across from Sicily to Italy, across the Strait of Messina. And around about the beginning of September, we began to move across. Now, I was sent across with my carriers, my mortars, in advance of the battalion, went across on a rather rickety old landing craft, got across the other side. And I had to go right round through the foot of Italy and underneath the instep of Italy and up the Adriatic coast. I was supposed to go across there as soon as possible because our people were coming across in landing craft and going round and landing near a place called Termoli, which is just up the Adriatic coast, side of the river Biferno. And so there was a huge crowd of vehicles of all sorts going right round, and we were literally swanning through southern Italy in beautiful sunshine, got right round, and then as we got turned, I say literally, we started on the toe of Italy, and went underneath Italy the toe, and round and up, started going up the coast. Just swanning along, and suddenly, as we got a little bit higher up, word came back, dispatch rider. He'd come back. There was a lot of soft-skinned vehicles, you know, car, trucks and so on ahead of me. And I was taken up to the bloke in charge of the column. Said, there are German tanks coming on. You're the nearest armour we've got. This was carriers, which you could put a bullet through from a 303 rifle. I want you at the head of the column. And I said, oh, God. So I told my bloke, I said, right, I'm going to put a speed on. And I was sitting, chewing a bit of chewing gum and trying to look as though I wasn't worried. And it was really serious because we got to some stages where there's some lorries had broken down and they just tipped them off the road to let me get by. And I went roaring up here. As I said, there was this place called Termoli, just over the river Biferno. And I went down on the river and it was being under a very heavy shell fire. It was like one of these sagas of the ancient Victorian times because there was a very primitive pontoon bridge across being held on ropes by the Royal Engineers for me to get across. And every single man had either one or two field dressing on them. And I'm just standing in the stream holding this pontoon thing. And we went across very slowly with our tracks dipping down to the water and got across on the other side. Then I raced round the road and got to this place, Termoli, where our people had just landed from landing craft. And there was a big town hall there. And outside lying dead were some of our dear friends, the German paras. And they rushed into the building here, because our blokes was fighting on the other side of the town hall, room by room. Went in here with my batman behind me, because I wanted to see the CO and see what I should do. I put my carriage up against the wall, you might say, you know. And kicked this door open, and there were some German paratroops laid out with their arms folded on their backs with candles at their head. And I discovered in the next room there were some... The Germans had two Italian girl nurses who were near me. These were dead Germans that were obviously for the last rites. We went in and got into the room and there were some Germans. I said, right, get in that corner. They were obviously being taken prisoner by some of our other people. And there was a German officer lying on a stretcher, spoke English. And he said, you have some very good machine guns. Oh, yes. I said, I know that. He said, I've got it through both thighs. Right. And his men were in the corner there. I said, well, now, you've got dressings on. Yes. Right. I said, as soon as we've cleared the rest of your friends out of here, we'll get you and your men away. And he called across, obviously in German. This officer says, we're going to get sent away as prisoners. But he said, we know very well, our friends are going to rescue us, aren't they? And these Germans started jumping them down. Jumping up and down, and very fierce those characters. Well, they had no weapons. So I said to the officer, you do understand English, because I had my Batman, very rough character here. I said, listen to my instructions I'm about to give to my servant here. 10 seconds after this German officer has finished speaking to his men, telling them to sit down, put their hands on their head and face the wall. If they have not done so, open up. And I shall also as well. The German officer, in alarm, lying on his stick, shouting across his people, turned on, faced the wall and sat like that. And I said, no, let him stay there. And then we got through for, and then the brigadier came up, and I went down to see him. They pretty well cleared the Germans out of here, and they were retreating through the town. And he said to me, there was the Argyle officer who'd won the VC on Longstop Hill, standing there, Jock Anderson, Major Anderson, and myself. And Swift, he said, right, I want one lot of carriers round that way and one round the other. At that time, I was, normally we had other carriers, but I had mortars, they were the only carriers at the time. And I said, which way do you go? I said, oh, make your own bloody minds up, I don't care whether you go, one of you go round that, one round that way. So I turned to Jock Anderson and said, well, Major Anderson, you're senior, where are you going to go? He said, well, I'll go round by the right. So I said, okay. I got my blokes and we were dashing out and way around the country to go around by the right of this. See, this terminal was at the end of a spur, and we went around that way. And once again, dead lucky, Jock Anderson took his carry around, and there was a sugar beet factory just on the road here with an 88mm gun in it. Blew him apart. He was killed just round the corner. If he said, I'll go left, I'd have been killed, you know. And I went along here, and our troops had pushed off from the ridge there, and I got along here to the point where I saw our people. And I had my car stretched along a road, and I'd already given them word that when I waved like that, they had to turn the carriage round. Instead of being line astern, they would then be long line, and push across the fields and up onto the side where the enemy were. And we were shot at all. The thing I remember was I went across a field that seemed to be full of pumpkins. And there was all chunks of pumpkins flying up through there from my tracks and slapping me in the face and so on. We got on the side of the hill, and I started working my way up. And the CO told me after, he said, I nearly died, Jack. They had been held up on the edge of the wood. And he said, I saw you going in on the right where there was no... we weren't there, they were just Germans. And I said, well, they must have been more frightened than us. They were paratroopers, but they moved up. And I got my carriage up, and then I saw the CO, and he sent somebody down. And I put my mortars in and started firing. There was a farm a little bit further away, about 700 yards away, and I was clattering. I could see Germans walking about. Then we advanced, our troops advanced, and I advanced with my mortars and got into position. And I went up there, and the shells were really coming down. And I saw something, it was getting towards the end of the day there. I saw something, an optical illusion called to the light. There was the setting sun against us in the west. And I suddenly saw a black spot, and I shoved, again, it was a scene, shoved that, well, look out! And I saw a small 88mm shell coming against the light. And Ian said, I wouldn't have bloody well been, but he said, you shoved me down, so you must have seen it. And one of the things there which stuck in my mind for a little while, the shells were falling among these people, and there was one man. He'd been almost totally disemboweled by a shell, and he was creeping on his hands and knees with his intestines catching around his knees and so on. And he just stopped and died just beside me, on his elbows, like, and on his knees with his intestines all hanging out. And we stayed there for a while. And at night, I went up. It was very wet. And I said to the CO, if Jerry uses tanks here, sir, I don't know what the hell we're going to do. He said, will you try and get some anti-tank guns up? So I went back and I tried to get some anti-tank guns up the side of the hill, and they were bogged down. I couldn't move them. And I went back. Up again. I saw the signals officer and I saw the CO. Signals officer was a bloke called Peter Peerless. I said, I'm just about buggered, Peter. I can't get these bloody anti-tank. And I told the CEO, he said, well, we'll just have to wait and see if some other way. He said, I know it's very difficult. He said, now don't you worry, Jack. Just you go back with your reserve motors and just stay there for a while and look out as soon as daylight comes. And at dawn, the Germans attacked. I suddenly saw our people streaming back and I saw the Germans coming. And there was a stage there when I couldn't open up on anybody because our fellows were among them. And they pulled back to the wood, you know. And the Germans came across and then they got cracking on them. Our machine gun got cracking and I got cracking with my mortars and they pulled back. And we were there in that position for a day while we got sorted out. We'd had quite a few casualties. And when the Germans were coming across, I saw one of those things which I suppose one doesn't like to mention. But there were some Germans coming on the flank and they put their hands up. There were the 10 or 12 put their hands up. Nick Schießen. And they came into our people, and when they got near, one of them threw a hand grenade. And there'd been a newly joined officer. I hadn't even been introduced to him in the one anyway. And he was castrated by this hand grenade as cleanly as it had been done by a surgeon. He'd just been married 3 weeks before. And our blokes just turned around as one man. And bit at these Germans. They were squealing like fury. There was one crept towards me with a great gash, because they still had short, the doctor, they still had short pants on these paratroops. Great gash, burning gash. He said, help, 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 you know, help. And I thought, Christ, there's an officer, I should do something about this. And I looked at two blokes coming for him. I stood back. And I heard the bayonets crossing his body, one from the back and one from the front. And then they kicked him off and buried him again and again, him screaming blue murder, and he was dead. Whole lot were killed, just because they're silly fool. I didn't blame our men. I mean, I know 11 of them didn't do an act of aggression, but this one did, and they must have all been in the know. Anyhow, they died. We didn't take any prisoners on that occasion.
Did you come across any other kind of actions like this?
Well, after that, later on, the next day, I killed the paratroop, or at least I contributed to it. Because I should say, the next day, I'd warned all my people, don't take any paratroops prisoner.
Why was this?
Because they were too treacherous, you know. Shoot them. Not unless, if they're wounded and they can't move, take them prisoner. But otherwise, and I remember the CO told me, because the infantry officers had a bit of and the CO told me to take a patrol up. And he said, we'll give you the biggest patrol we've ever put out, Jack. And I took 100 men with hand grenades and Tommy guns and so on. And we went up on the hill, and there were a lot of our blokes still dead around there, and some German paratroops, and up against this farm. And this bloke was still kneeling on his knees with his intestines wrapped around his knees, poor lad. This officer, Peter Peerless, our signalling officer, he was lying there dead. And I walked 50 paces, picked his leg up and walked back and put it beside his body. He'd been hit by an 88mm, the tanks had come across, you know. And I should tell you, before I take you on this patrol, when the Germans had come across, where my mortars were, the buffs came streaming across here. It's wrong to say that they were retreating unnecessarily, but they were moving rather fast for infantry soldiers. Because I called out, there was no officer, and I called out, Sergeant Major, get your men on that railway line there. And there was a couple of anti-tank guns belonging to the buffs. And I could see the tanks going around on our right. And my mortars were no good at them. And I hadn't any men to man the anti-tank guns, the six-pounders. So I said, right, change to smoke. If we can't penetrate them, we'll smoke the buggers out. The ventilation louvers will take smoke and it'll make the buggers cough to do nothing else. So I fired smoke at these tanks with passings on that side. And on just one occasion, I rushed across. I saw a big paratroop standing against a tree. And just over there was this anti-tank run, pointing that direction. So I flopped and sat in the seat and got the sight on him and pressed the trigger. It was a pistol grip for you. The tree and the parachute disappeared. First time I fired a six-pound solid shot. But I got to the stage there when, you know, you sometimes got to the stage, if I may just diversify a little bit, you know, Winston Churchill was supposed to have said, or he made a speech which he never made, but he was going to say in it when the possible invasion was outside, if you've got to go, take one with you. Now, I think that was one of the most profoundest thoughts possible, because that's exactly how I felt, you know, when I saw the Germans passing the answer, and I thought, well, not much chance here, but if I've got to go, we'll take one or two with us, you know, and that was why I fired a six-pound shot and the paratrooper in the side of a tree. I gouged, and there was a big blood-stained gouge on the edge of the tree when I looked at it later. And the Germans then retreated there, they were pushed back. As I say, I took this patrol up the next day, and just in the scrub behind the bat, there was a paratrooper suddenly stood up. And there was a private soldier with me, and I had my Tommy gun, and I let him have a burst, and the private soldier fired his rifle. And the bloke collapsed onto his back, and his feet were quivering together, and he's at death throes. And I rushed up, and on this side he had a magazine, and this side he had the Luger. And I grabbed the magazine, and the soldier grabbed the Luger, and I said, I'll toss you. If you win, I'll give the magazine to you. If I win, you sell the Luger to me, will you? He said, okay, sir. And he won, so I gave him. I just thought to myself later, this bloke was still twitching his death throes while we were talking. And then it struck me later, he'd never drawn his Luger. I suspect he was going to give himself up, but I never took any chances with paratroopers. And I went up and we recovered the bodies. The Roman Catholic padre came up, and later the Church of England padre, and I'd spent my time and lifted some of our blocks that had gotten into slit trenches, you know, to avoid the tanks, and some had been run over, turning them up, you know. And I remember some of them were lying, they'd gone into the slit trench like that and stiffened, and when you turned them over at the back, their feet and arms were up in the air, and I was taking their identification, fastening around the wrist, so that the... I remember there was a Roman Catholic there, and you say a silly thing for that meaning, but they were lying there, and the Church of England padre came along and was just going to kneel down. I said, padre, no poaching, RC. He said, Jack, how can you make jokes on such a terrible occasion? I said, well, what do you want me to do, padre? Burst into tears. But we've got them all.
Was it a growing response to paratroopers, German paratroopers, that you felt that you had to...
Yes, away? Yes. Yes, that's what I felt, because you see, there were intrinsically at that time there were also political troops. There were tough troops, well trained, but I didn't trust them. Later on, as I tell you, I had another reason not to trust them, because we pursued them through the mountains, and on the next occasion we got into engagement, we went up, and we were following them through, and they had to retire. We shelled this small village, and they obviously had to retire because there was no chance. They knew we were going to come up. And I took the patrol up in the moonlight, because I hadn't any mortar targets, and the CO sent me up. I took this patrol up in the moonlight, and I went along the edge of the village and found no Germans, and came back and established a post. And it was a moonlight autumn evening. Incidentally, it was October the 5th when we attacked the Germans up on there.
Whereabouts were you? Any idea?
I think it was a place called Monte Cilfone, on the outside of Termoli, you know. But I heard a confused noise coming in the night. So I stood everybody to and watched. And coming back down the road in the moonlight, a whole lot of weeping little teenage Italians, the Germans had taken away and raped them thoroughly and sent them back in the village. And then when morning came, and the Italians were so delighted to see that we were British, you know. And the Germans, before they left, they shot all the kittens and pups belonging to the little children. And then they sat down and evacuated their bowels onto newspapers and flung them around all the ceilings and stucco ceilings and so on of the houses. That's typical German lavatory humour, you know. And
And this made your men angry?
Oh, yes. Yes, oh, yes, particularly so. Especially, silly enough, they could stand being shot themselves, but to shoot the pups and kittens of the little kids, half of them, a lot of them had children, you know.
And this lead to a no quarter given sense of approach to it?
I suspect it might well have. Whether reinforcements who came later might have had a more time, but I thought we would never have shown any mercy to the paratroopers. And we went further into the hills and pushed them back. We were pushing back all the way. And then we suddenly were pulled back. And you know, in the Adriatic, the rivers run down from the mountains almost parallel. Some of them you can call rivers, as are torrentes, T-O-R-R-E-N-T, just swift-flowing rivers, you know. And the next place we wanted to attack was a place called Vasto, which was across another river, you know. Not to be fair, no. I can't remember the name later. And I had mules then. I had Indian Army mules, because that was the famous occasion when I had Sikhs. And you know, the rule with mules was, when you had proper mules, if you were going up hill country where there was a bit of rise, continual rise, you only loaded with 75 pounds on each pannier, 150 pounds. But if you were going through undulating country, which was in the base flat, you could put another 30 pounds on. Well, 30 pounds meant three more 10-pound mortar bombs. And remember this Sikh Naik, the men up lovely, lent from the Indian Army. The Naik corporal could speak English. And I said, right, we're going to load these mortars and ammunition on these mules, and I want 90 pounds on each pannier. And he said, my captain sahib say 75 pounds on each pannier. I said, I'm your captain sahib while you're under in my charge. Do you understand? He said, yes, sahib. Right, 90 pounds on each pannier. He said, no, sahib, 75 pounds on each pannier. Well, I hadn't enough in here, so I took my revolver and put it in his ribs and said, 90 pounds on each pannier. And he said, yes, captain sahib. And so we got loaded up. And the thing I remember was, we're going across this river. It was a Trino, River Trino, T-R-I-G-N-O. And it was very cold at the time. It must have been mid-October or something. And inevitably the mule stuck in the middle. And they all sent back, Captain Williams, come back, because I was supposed to be the ones who could get the mules forward. And they used to stand in the middle of the river for no reason. I remember I got off the first one. And mules are sexless creatures. And I used to get hold of the band and, come on, boy, if it wouldn't work. I'd give it a kick where its testicles would have been if it had had any, you know. Arr, you know, and get it moving that way. And every time I kicked like that, my bottom dipped in the freezing water, you know. And I managed to get I had 12 mules, managed to get them across. And I know when I got across the other side, I changed my socks. But we had to lie on the sort of riverbank undercover, waiting for dawn to attack, and lying in the moonlight, because it was beautiful moonlight. I remember watching my trousers all turning beautiful white right up to my thighs where I'd been wading through the river, and my bottom was hoar frost and so on. And then we went into the attack, and we really got shot up as we were moving in. And I told my men, lie down, you know, because the mules were just standing and they were just lying around. And as I looked across, I saw one mule fly up in the air with a man attached to it. I thought, good God, there's one gone. And suddenly I saw a figure scrambling across out of the smoke and debris. And there's this Sikh. And he cast across to me and he said, Chitti Sahib. I said, Chitti? Why Chitti? He said, mule dead. You wanted me to sign a chitty on the battlefield to say it's been killed. I think he thought his company officer would think he'd flogged it or something. Go on, get over there. And we got up and we advanced, and I fired one or two more, but not many, because I was only, you could see a few sort of olive groves and so on. And I can honestly say I didn't even see where the enemy had, just where the enemy might be, you know. And when we got up the top there, we got on this ridge and drove into, and we could bring our transport up, carriers up by road then, because we'd come up round through the river and up that way. And I called this Naik up and I said, you do understand English? He said, yes, Captain Sahib. I said, well, I wish you to say to your men, and I say to you, thank you very much indeed for your help. You've been very brave men. Thank you very much indeed. And he was standing there, and I put my hand out to shake hands with him. He took my hand and burst into tears. I think they were rather rigid in there. I said, OK, thank you very much. I'll take your mules away. And he sort of waved rather unmilitarily when he went away. And I got myself on carriage and went into the town, Vasto. And then we went across the river Sangro. Our people then equated that. Sangue is the Italian word for blood. And the Sangro was a broader river, and it was quite a battle to get across there. And we had quite a few casualties. And I was firing across the river at possible targets. I was never very happy that I was hitting anything effectively, you know. And we got across. There was a concert, not only us, but a concert. And then suddenly we were pulled out and sent up into the mountains, which was a very sort of just German patrols and our patrols. It was very pleasant. But we had German ski troops against us because we were in deep snow. And that was a famous occasion when we sent to headquarters and said, look, these Germans, they've got great advantage over us. They're all dressed in white from top to toe. They can cross the snow fields and we can hardly see them. We are plodding around in our khaki. Could we have some sort of camouflage? And the geniuses from back sent us up a stack of dirty grey blankets with a hole in the middle. We wandered around looking like Mexican ponchos wearing, you know. We said, the stupid buggers, and slung them off. And it was also at that time that they said, it was getting towards December by the time we'd gone there. We hadn't had much in action, except, I say, sporadic, you know. And we were, they said, everybody fighting above 4,000 feet would get a high-altitude ration. We thought, oh, lovely. Because the compo, you know, you got... The best one was type A, was steak and kidney pudding. And I was talking among my bloke. I said, I wonder what they'll give us. Do you think an extra steak and kidney pudding or something like that? Christ, I said, that sounds a good idea. Eventually it came. Quarter of an ounce of tea and 1 2-ounce bar of chocolate extra per week for all ranks. That was a high-altitude ration for fighting above 4,000 feet. And then we were pulled out of the line, we went into rest near a place called Campo Basso, in the mountains, and up to a place called Baranello. Now, when we arrived there, the first thing our troops did spontaneously, with a typical poor Italian village that had been short of rations and all sorts of things while the Germans had been running around, the extra chocolate we got, remember, there was about 800 or 900 men in there, the men gave it up and told the quartermaster to find how many children there were in the village. And all the little kids in the village got a Christmas box of 2 ounce bars of chocolates from our battalion.
What was the men's attitudes towards the Italians who'd been their enemies just a short time ago?
They were such nice people, you know. I mean, I've heard about these bastards of Mussolini's men, what they did to the Yugoslavs and so on. But the Italian people, they were such very nice people, you know. And I was billeted with a... there was a little factory making terracotta, you know, these tiles. And I had a room in there, and my men were billeted round about. And there was an old Italian woman there, spoke terrible Bronx Italian. And the little kid were crying like, che fa, bambino, what happened to ah, them kids, it's always bawling, she said, you know, she used to talk like that to me. And eventually she was very standoffish, but she got friendly and I used to go and have a drink at night, you know, a drink of wine. So she'd been a local girl, they were rather well to do, these people. And she showed me a head, great gouge, bullet hole through her head. There was a, when she was 13, there was a, one of the local swains asked her parents if they could pay court to her. And they wouldn't, the parents said no, she was too young. So went out to her church one Sunday and shot her, tried to shoot her, and gouged the top of her head. So she was sent across to New York. It'd be safe. Hence this appalling Bronx accent she had, you know.
When did you next go into action?
Well, when we left them, it was a new year, on New Year's Day. We left in heavy snow. We went into action. And we were in front. I don't know what sort of troops were there. No, just ordinary panzer grenadiers. And we exchanged shots and we were doing patrols. Deep snow, and there was a village on the top which was occupied by the Germans. And one day a little boy came down to the colonel with a note written by a schoolmistress which said that the local priest was taking food away from the villagers to give to the Germans. And also there were no virgins above the age of 13 years in the village because of this priest. Could we do something about it? So the CEO said, Jack, you can speak a little bit of Italian. Have a look up and see. So I crept away up through the snow and got at the end of the village and saw a man, called him over. And I said, as a British officer, he said, he was very pleased to see me. And I said, is it the fact that your priest is assisting the Germans? He said, yes, Capitano, he is. He's not a good priest. Well, I said, we'll have to do something about that, won't we? He said,